This is the MagicWordPodcast.com.
Hello, this is Scott Wells for the MagicWordPodcast.com. This episode is brought to you by people like Peter Hanway, the newest member of the Friends of the Magic Word. It's thanks to financial supporters like Peter that help keep this podcast going. If you have the financial means to help on a one-time or an ongoing basis, please go over to the Magic Word Podcast and you'll see a tab there where you can click on Become a Friend of the Magic Word, and you can learn more about it. I've even got a little video that tells you about why that I can use your money and your support to help keep this podcast going. So if you got a few minutes, go over, take a look, and give us some help if you can. Well, our guest this week on the podcast is Larry Becker. I spoke with Larry via Skype back in March of 2017, and I had held on to this for a while because he said, well, I'll send you some photos, because he didn't have any JPEGs he could email to me or anything, and so it's fine. I was waiting for those, and anyhow, I never got them, and I said, well, I'm going to be coming out to Phoenix sometime to visit some family, and so I'll have a chance to stop by your house and visit, and one thing led to another. Time slipped away, and so it wasn't until here this past week, here in October, when I had an opportunity to go to Phoenix and went over to his home to visit with him and his lovely wife, April. And I got the photos so this way I could do a high-resolution scan. So the leading up to that, even well before the conversation we had this past March, I want to thank Jonathan Levy, who was instrumental in really kind of pushing me forward to get this conversation recorded, because he has sent me emails, he has sent me texts, he sent me private messages on Facebook, saying, hey, you got to talk to Larry, you need to get this down. Okay, fine. So I did. And then afterwards, Paul Romney, with his wonderful digital magazine Vanish, is going to take some of the excerpts from this and going to transcribe it. And so if you miss hearing it here, you'll see it in his magazine, and he'll also be taking some of the photos that you might see here as well that will be published in his high-resolution digital Vanish magazine, which is free, by the way, also, just like this podcast is free. Anyhow, I got an opportunity then to go and visit then with Larry. I didn't record anything during our conversation. We kind of rehashed this, essentially, a lot of the things that we had previously discussed this past March. But I did get to have a wonderful time with him. He shared some stories with me that we had already, again, discussed, and you'll hear on this podcast. And one of the things I think was interesting, too, is that he developed a lot of wonderful leather goods over in England. He became good friends with Roy Roth, who was a leather maker. And so a lot of his stuff was made over there, and he had done a lot of lecture tours throughout the UK. Well, he, of course, then got linked up with Lee Earle, and they formed their partnership of Mentalism Unlimited, and that ran for a long number of years. And in this podcast, he talks about his relationship with Lee, and then eventually when they split and went their own ways. And there are a lot of other things that Larry talks about here in this podcast as well, including his early days. And it was interesting to know that his father was a band leader and knew Cardini. Golly, I'm getting ahead of myself. I don't want to spoil too much. I think you'll enjoy this podcast. I was holding this off until sometime around Halloween, and this is being broadcast then right now prior to Halloween, just the week before, because it has a lot to do with mentalism. And around Halloween, a lot of times, of course, I'm thinking of seances and bizarre magic and different kinds of things. Well, mentalism can fall into that category as well. So that's why that I thought this would be a nice little Halloween episode or podcast, and save his conversation and release this now in conjunction with the Halloween season. And speaking of that, by the way, if you are thinking of going into having your own seance or doing something like that, you might be interested then in the information that Jamie Salinas and I had published in our on our booklet. So if you'll just go over to the website at themagicwordpodcast.com, you'll see a tab there that says Scott Wells Lecture Notes, and then you can click on the little picture that says Creating the Paranormal Experience. And these were our original lecture notes that Jamie Salinas and I had put together and presented at the Mindvention a few years ago and had plans to put together a book. But unfortunately, someone else had taken our idea and published it themselves. Anyhow, so I suggest that if, again, you're looking to do some seances, never too late. If you've already got something planned, you might find something in there that might give you some additional tips on how to market your seance, how to put it together, how to put some butts in the seats, I guess, basically. So it's a great little PDF that you can download and learn some stuff, plus a couple of cool tricks you might think about adding to your seance. Or if you're going to be doing some sort of a paranormal or bizarre or a Halloween show of any type, going to be for some adults that includes some strolling, there are some ideas in here that might help you that you can do a couple of tricks. So it's very inexpensive. At only $10, how can you go wrong? So anyhow, something to take a look at. All right, well, it's time to get into this week's podcast. And again, I want to thank Jonathan Levy and Paul Romney for encouraging me to get this done. But most of all, I really want to thank April Becker for helping as well. And most of all, of course, then to the star who is our guest this week. Please welcome Larry Becker here on The Magic Word. Hello, this is Scott Wells for themagicwordpodcast.com, and today I have with me, all the way from Scottsdale, Arizona, someone who many of you around the world know as one of the leading mind readers and mentalists, who has been in the profession for a long number of years, and back when mentalism wasn't cool, he was the coolest, and he remains such today. Please welcome my guest today, Mr. Larry Becker. Hi there, Larry.
Hi.
So glad to have you over here. You know, as I recall, you, for the longest time, I thought were in Scott-Free, Arizona. And I thought, what a great name for a place, Scott-Free, Arizona. And then, is that right?
Scottsdale.
Well, you're in Scottsdale. Okay. I was thinking there was some Carefree. That's what I was thinking. Were you in Carefree, Arizona?
Yeah, originally. When we moved here, we built a home in Carefree.
Yes.
And then later on, we moved over to the Boulders, which is where we live now.
Right.
And that's Scottsdale.
And Carefree was not that far away. And actually, Carefree is kind of a suburb of Phoenix, I guess, like Scottsdale.
Yeah, same.
Yeah. Just different part of town over there. Well, yes, yep. I said that you've been around doing mentalism for such a long number of years, and actually where I had first become aware of you was, golly, you know, years ago when Stevens Magic Emporium and Joe Stevens had started the video series, and he used to have the Baker's Dozen that you would get. You pay for 12 videos, and you get 13 or something, and you were
right.
one of the videos that had come through on that. So that must have been quite an experience, because that was kind of in the early days, the very beginning days, I guess, of teaching videos.
Yeah, absolutely. That was a long time ago.
That does kind of date it back. When would that have been? In the 70s, 80s, early 80s, perhaps, early 80s, maybe.
Something or like that. Maybe even earlier than that. Or
earlier than that, yeah, I was going to say. Now, Mike, how did Joe find you? Or were you friends with Joe Stevens, or did you contact him?
Yes.
Or, okay.
I came in and spent a couple of days, and we did the recordings.
Mm-hmm.
And I still managed to keep contact with Mark Stevens.
As far as working with Joe back then, that I think you were probably the only mentalist that he had recorded or done as part of his series, particularly, I think, early on over there. How was it that that came about? How did your relationship blossom? How did you first meet Joe, and how did that come about?
We're probably both too old to remember the reason why, but I've known Joe for 15 years.
Yeah, but you'd obviously been doing some mentalism before that, and were you performing like for corporate shows or doing trade shows, or what kind of mentalism audience did you have?
Basically, I didn't and wasn't active performing until I got to Arizona.
Oh.
And here, the local community foundation would auction me off every year,
mm-hmm.
to people who wanted home entertainment.
Okay.
And that's when I began to perform, actually, out here. Before that, we were just living here.
Right.
And I wasn't doing much of anything. I retired in 1985, and at that time I was really performing and lecturing around the world.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was in 85 that I did my longest trek throughout Europe. But in terms of active performing, well, right now I am going on 88.
Wow, okay. 88 years young. There you go.
Yeah, right. And I'm just lucky to be able to hold my head up.
Well, that's good. Every day, yeah, just keep getting out of bed and lifting it up, putting one foot in front of the other. Well, back at that time when you were before you retired, what was your profession? I'd forgotten. I know, but I had forgotten.
Advertising.
In advertising. Was it with an ad agency, or are you in special advertising?
Yeah,
okay.
Ad agency. I was the creative partner in a New Jersey advertising agency, And that's where I retired from in 1985. They were probably glad to see me go.
You know, I find that fascinating, absolutely fascinating. The reason is that my undergraduate degree was in advertising, and my goal as a student when I was in college was to work for an advertising agency because I think that mentalists and magicians as well use some not just advertising, but the skills of an advertiser. That is, that we are always trying to figure out what it is that people want and then provide them with that service, but also, more importantly, to try to capitalize on the positive and minimalize the negative. So this way that, in other words, if you're trying to hide something, which magicians will do, you don't want them to see certain things, and so you're trying to direct or misdirect them from certain places. Or I should say, yeah, really, as Tommy Wonder would say, you're directing them away from what you want them to see and in order to fool somebody. So in other words, that as a salesman, and particularly as an advertiser, that you're trying to sell certain things to get people to believe what you're selling. So you have to have that conviction. And that's no more evident, I think, than in mentalism, where it's all done with the mind, where you're trying to convince someone that what you're trying to sell them is true. So that seems to be a perfect alignment, being in advertising as a partner as you were, and retiring from that into doing full-time mentalism.
Yeah, it's the creative aspect.
Sure.
Of what I did for a living for many years. And when I did retire, for some reason or other, the local magicians in the Scottsdale area thought it would be nice if I moved here.
Yeah.
So there was a lot of campaigning, primarily with Bob Blumley.
Yes.
And that's the reason why we came in this direction. I retired to Florida. Mm-hmm. When I left the agency. And funny, I got a phone call, I guess it's close to a year ago, from my former partner. And during our conversation, I said, Dick, you were there. Who was I? What the hell did I do?
Uh-huh.
And his classic five words. He said, you were a multifaceted genius.
Wow. What a compliment.
And after our 20 years together and coming from him, that's probably the greatest compliment that I ever got.
Wow.
He retired from life not long after. So
now, when you were on the creative side of that, did you do television ads, print ads, and all those kinds of things? That was on the creative side that you did, I assume?
Oh, sure. Mm-hmm. Everything.
Yeah.
From print on up, radio, TV.
I always admired the creative team, because when I had visited ad agencies, these guys worked at all hours of the day or night, whatever time, you know, it seems like that it fit with them, because some guys could think better at night, or also the types of things that they would put on the walls or the furniture they would have or whatever. I mean, everyone has their own creative muse, if you will. And same thing like with mind reading or magic. You know, when you're coming up with ideas, did you find that there were things that, as you had created commercials and advertising, that there were some things that had an overlap, if you will, I guess, with mentalism, and that kind of made you think, oh, this is something that I could, you know, use as a routine?
I don't think that I even tried to connect the two.
Oh, interesting.
You're either creative or you're not creative. My creativity ran through what I made a living at. Mm-hmm. And in terms of magic, I created magic. My start was visiting Phil Thomas with the Yogi Magic Mart in Baltimore.
Okay.
I probably didn't have enough money in those days to do anything but outfox my younger brother, who was always hitting up her relatives. And I always knew where to go to get the money. And as he remembers to this day, that the 10 bucks that I spent on a change bag.
Yeah.
He said, I could have been eating candy. And you're waving that 10 bag around.
Yeah.
He was 4 years younger. At any rate, that's where I started. And that was the first magic shop that I found.
Uh-huh.
Prior to that, it was very difficult to find any magic. But once I made the connection there, and I think a lot of magicians in Baltimore grew up in that shop.
How was it that you went into the magic shop to begin with? Had you seen a magician or a mind reader or someone perhaps on TV or someplace that inspired you to even stop in?
Yeah, I got into magic primarily through my dad, who was a popular Baltimore orchestra leader. In fact, over the years, he had owned a nightclub over top of the Stanley Theater in downtown Baltimore called the Penthouse.
Uh-huh.
And in addition to knowing professional magicians, when I showed an aptitude and really began to fall into this trap,
right,
that I've right. spent over 80 years at. It's funny. But I met some of the real pros, like Cardini. My first meeting with Cardini, I gave an interview to whoever wrote the book on Cardini, and I've forgotten the name. There was a good hardbound book on Cardini. At any rate, I related the story of how I met Cardini. He was appearing in town, and my father, who encouraged me by introducing me to real pros, introduced me to Cardini, and I remembered him asking me if I could do the pass, and I said stupidly, yes.
Yeah.
And he handed me a deck of cards.
And he said, here, boy, do it.
Yeah, right. And it was probably the worst pass ever attempted. But I fumbled through it. And then he took the cards back, and he says, no, it should not look like what
that.
You did.
Yeah.
This is the way it should be performed. And he did a pass. And, of course, I didn't see anything.
Uh-huh.
And nothing moved, no flutter, no nothing. And he then showed me the top card of the deck, and there it was, and it had traveled there. And my nose was right over that deck. I never saw a thing.
Wow.
So,
did he teach you his method?
No.
Nope.
But over the years, I did receive old apparatus long out of use. But I added it to my collection,
mm-hmm.
which I gave away when I went into the Army in 51. And wouldn't you know it, I wasn't in the Army more than a week when I was asked to do magic shows.
Oh, really?
And I had to, in order to get rope, I had to go cut down the rope off of Venetian blinds.
Yeah.
And just scourge together, you know,
right,
crap that I could do. And I did perform while I was in the Army.
And so after that, I assume they asked you to do more shows.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And right up until the time I was discharged, I think my most ambitious mental effect was the last show I did while in the Army.
Mm-hmm.
I had set up to make a phone call and connect with my wife at that time, who was on the line, and I had the phone already. I had made the connection.
Mm-hmm.
So she could hear what was going on in the room that I was performing in. And it was, the question was something, what was your favorite foreign travel that you still remember?
Yeah.
And she heard all of the replies, including the last one, which was the commanding officer of the unit I was with at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And I feigned that I called a stranger, and I asked them to think of their favorite city worldwide. And obviously she had heard
right.
the answers. So when I handed the phone to the colonel, he almost dropped the phone
oh.
when she revealed the city he was thinking of. I think I capped off the story with the final, which was during the week after. I walked into his office, and he questioned me on the appearance of the pad that I was using.
Oh, interesting. Okay. Of your apparatus, really. Okay.
Uh-huh. Yeah, right. And I started laughing, and he was standing there wondering what the hell I was laughing at.
Uh-huh.
The inglorious, what he remembered
right.
from having been one of the people that I had approached prior to the show.
Was that one of the things, I guess, that you saw what an impression that a small thing, that is, with a little apparatus, I mean, it wasn't like stage illusions or anything, that kind of impressed you to think, hey, I need to maybe start doing more of this kind of thing, more of mentalism as opposed to less magic and more mentalism?
I think I was already into
uh-huh.
the mentalism. When I began to write, the first two books that I wrote was World of Supermentalism,
mm-hmm.
1 and 2. And by then I had finally met my lifetime partner,
mm-hmm.
who is still around.
Good.
And
how long have you and April been married?
42 years.
42 years, yes. Yep. My wife and I will celebrate our 42nd anniversary here this next month, in fact, too.
Oh. Yeah, well, she's been around through everything.
Yeah.
But there were two other marriages prior to
mm-hmm.
finally meeting her. You know when you finally find your life mate, you know when it is.
Sure.
That's the reason why when we met and we stuck together and our 42nd or 43rd
mm-hmm.
anniversary just went by. So she's been terrific through it.
Now, you mentioned about the thing with the telephone call. You know, the first thing I was thinking of was the Piddingtons, who used to do a kind of a remote viewing type of a thing, or he would talk with her over the radio or something kind of like that. So, first of all, did you ever know the Piddingtons? Are you familiar with them?
Yeah, I'm familiar with them, but I never met them.
Okay. And second of all, did you and April ever do like a two-person mind reading? I mean, that seems to be quite popular. You know, Tommy Tenn and Emily do that, and Jeff and Tessa Evison, and Christian Catalina Painter. There are several people who have wonderful, and the list goes on. But did you do the two-person mind reading also?
No.
Okay.
And the reason was simply that she didn't want to waste her time memorizing code.
Yeah, yeah.
And I had too many methods of getting information.
Mm-hmm.
It just wasn't necessary. So I never pressed her to do it, and she never did.
Hmm. Interesting. Well, as far as then continuing to create, whenever that you retired, I guess, at 85, then you decided that, I'm going to go out then to into mentalism and start lecturing and creating more of these kinds of things. You know, going back to that video with Joe Stevens in his video series, one of the things that I learned from you was a variation of room service, I guess, with a room key and with, you know, 0 through 9 numbers and the way they'd
yep.
be added up and everything. That was a fantastic routine, and I put together my own presentation with that, and I had that as part of my routine for probably 15 years. It was just wonderful. And then later with the Casino Royale, that was another thing that you had come out with, I believe. And you had a Casino Royale Lite that came up after that. And
You got a good memory.
So, and I had a little variation on that in which that I actually used some real poker chips that I got from Las Vegas. And so I figured out a way to do that, just a little bit different method, but with the same presentation, basically, that Casino Royale was wonderful, and it still is. And I think I used that just a couple of months ago on a show still. So there are a lot of things. And then, of course, you mentioned the world of Mentalism 1 and 2, and then Stunners came out. Was it shortly thereafter, or how long did that, was it before that came out? What year was that? Do you remember?
It was in the late 80s.
Okay.
So I'm only guessing.
Yeah.
If it wasn't so lazy, I'd walk across the room
and look it up. Well, that's okay. So now the world of Mentalism 1 and 2, those were pretty good-sized books, as I recall, too. I mean, I don't remember if they were as large as Stunners, because I know Stunners was 300 pages or something.
I'm just looking at Volume 1 of World of Super Mentalism. I probably have the only bound edition of that, but the original cover is in this book, and that was 1977.
Hmm. Okay.
And the typing on this was by April Becker.
There you go. Who published that?
I did.
You did, okay. And that was hardbound?
Yeah. Actually, the gentleman who I gave permission to print it actually had these bound and sent to me.
Mm-hmm.
The soft cover is actually bound in the copies that I have. So they were, you know, soft covers.
Now, why did you have volumes 1 and 2? Did you feel like that there was more material and you came out then later with 2? Or that it was, you had that from the original start and you wanted to do 2 volumes? Or what was your intent there?
Actually, when the material that went into volume 1, and that was completed, and that's the one that I chose to sell.
Mm-hmm.
I had so much material left over that wasn't used. That's what created Volume 2.
Okay. So it wasn't that this was like stuff that wasn't as good enough to go into number 1. It was just you still had a lot of good, strong material enough to make a very good...
That's correct.
Yeah. You have a favorite for each of those books, that particular routine that you really... kind of a pet routine you almost wish you hadn't released or didn't want to at the time? Are you really one of your favorites?
There were too many of those.
I'm sure that's true.
Big mouth.
Yeah. Well, in that regard, you know, a lot of times magicians and mentalists are very secretive and don't want to release certain things. But, you know, why was it then that you felt like, okay, I want to put this in writing? Was it because just, well, I'm not going to put words in your mouth. Why was that?
Well, the material that's in here is actually usable today. Things like It's in the Bag, and Foretold, Sum Total is one that I have used that for so many years. I stopped during my many excursions into different subject matter. I went and attended seminary, and I was scheduled to come home at Christmas, and we had a party at the home, one of our esteemed leaders. And when I finished performing the Sum Total, he said something to me. He says, "Oh, that's the old 111.
Okay.
And he had absolutely recognized the basis of which the trick was originated anyhow.
Was he a magician or a mentalist?
He was. He is now the top guy. I served under his predecessor. I can't think of the name.
Our bishop?
Yeah, right.
Okay. There you go.
And there's so many funny stories that occurred while I was at seminary. One was we never wore the cassock outside of the seminary. And one morning, the bishop asked me to run down, pick up some bagels and cream cheese.
Yeah.
And so I didn't have time to take off the cassock. And when I got to the corner, somebody was kneeling next to me. And he looked up at me, and I looked down at him, and he says, "Father," he says, "I am hungry." I said, "Well, you came to the right place." Took him across the street, bought him breakfast, yeah, and then took the remnants back to our leader.
Mm-hmm.
And interesting stories. And I have an awful tendency to go where no magician has ever gone before,
yeah,
especially in mentalism. In fact, I think I lost my closest friend over the past few months, Bob Cassidy.
Yeah, it's not been a good year. I know that a lot of people have passed here. Bob was a great guy then, too. You know, I had a lot of conversations with Bob, and one of the things that I had as a takeaway from him when we talked about performing on stage was to know your performing persona. That is, basically, know your powers. In other words, you shouldn't necessarily try to do everything in which that you can be a clairvoyant, where you can bend silver, you have psychokinetic powers, and that you have precognitive powers, and that you, in other words, it kind of tends to jumble together. On the other hand, not doing everything, it's one prediction after another, you know. So when you perform, what kind of powers do you project to have on stage?
My mentalism was presented in a very commercial way,
mm-hmm,
because I had learned from so many pros that my father gave me and whose material I collected, including some of the props that they used.
Mm-hmm.
And
so you mix mentalism with magic in your performances?
I think that the magic, of course, as I got more into the mentalism, I began covering it up, paying more attention to the fact that it was not magic. But I remember the first magic show that I went to, the first important magic show, which my kid brother and I, my father had dropped us off, and we saw Dante. But I had a very, a commercial approach. By the time I came to Scottsdale, people who hired me to come to their homes and to perform for dinners and parties that they held, I had no problem in fitting in with that group because I was in the same group. And that set up a wonderful connection with the people that I performed for. I was one of them.
Mm-hmm.
So it started off, even though I met people that I had never met before, I was well known in this area, and people knew my connections. Here's a framed newspaper article sitting here under the computer. Becker inducted into the Society of American Magicians Hall of Fame. The story was, the Society of American Magicians has recently honored Larry Becker, internationally acclaimed mentalist, magician, author, and lecturer. Becker was inducted into the prestigious Society of American Magicians Hall of Fame, which honors stars of magic from Harry Houdini to David Copperfield. Author of numerous best-selling books on the subject of mental magic, Becker was honored in 1993 by the Christopher Foundation for his book, Stunners. There we go, 1993.
That's when it came out, 93, yeah.
And a 464-page opus considered by many to be the definitive book on mental magic. Featured in the book is Becker's death-defying version of Russian roulette, the sensational illusion that has been the focus of bewilderment and controversy, especially controversy, for many years because of its danger to the performer. The Christopher Awards were established in memory of professional magician, author, and magical historian Milburn Christopher, a native of Baltimore, Maryland. And I met Christopher in the early days.
Was that right? That was when you were just getting started, I guess, since you lived in Baltimore, and you were still with the ad agency back then. So you had, how did you come to associate or meet Milburn Christopher back then?
No, he was appearing at the Hippodrome Theater. And I was working at the loan shop next door. And one of the things that came across my counter was a watch which appeared. It was a wonderful little piece, and I have no idea where the hell it came from or why it even was created. But it was a thing that you could hold in your hands, press the sides, the face of the watch would spin around and end up in an up position so you could read the...
Yeah. Is it a pocket watch or a wristwatch?
No, this was a pocket watch.
Okay.
And it to me, you know, anything that operated in a magical way...
Interested you, sure.
Immediately went to my pocket. And I went next door and told Christopher that I had a little item in the shop next door. Would he mind coming by? I thought he'd be interested in seeing it. Mm-hmm. He did, and he was. But it wasn't something that you could actually, I mean, you could do magic with it, but who the hell wants that? You know, It's obvious from the way it operates that is the only thing that's unusual about the object.
Right.
And to just show, you're better off of taking your wristwatch off and handing it to the person.
Right.
But he thought it was interesting, and which is what I felt when I looked at it. And he agreed. He says that would make a good mental magic effect.
Yeah, there is differences between mentalism and mental magic.
That's right. And that was definitely in the mental magic category, which he was not interested in.
Right. Now, is that something more that you did? Did you feel like that what you were doing is more mental magic, or do you try to focus just on pure mentalism?
No, I saw nothing wrong with combining the two.
Mm-hmm. I know some guys are purists and will say, no, you know, shouldn't.
Mm-hmm. Especially, you know, I'm one of the founders of the PEA. Mm-hmm. And being part of that group, I became more conscious of the divide between those who performed real mentalism and those who performed mental magic. And I never hid that. I mean, mm-hmm. I think most of the magicians who read my material could tell the difference. There was no real attempt to make what I was doing into real mentalism. And that's because 95% of it was accomplished through magic.
Right.
And very little of the, you know, subliminal this, that, the other.
Right, but made to look like mentalism or
made
some sort of...
Made to look like mentalism, mm-hmm. Yeah. Hmm. But that's where I came from. That's what I did.
Do you have somebody that you had really looked up to, as you had mentioned about Cardini and Melbourne Christopher, but, I mean, did you ever get a chance to meet Annemann or Dunninger?
No, neither one.
Okay. I just wonder if there was someone who you had aspired to be like, or someone perhaps even today that you think is exceptional.
I mean, I felt that I had a closer connection with Melbourne Christopher and Hen Fetch and the magicians of that era.
So that relationship, based upon that first conversation you had with the pocket watch with Melbourne Christopher, blossomed
right.
into a friendship.
Yep. And over the years, I became friendly with people like Hen Fetch.
Mm-hmm.
And even had problems with them in coming to lectures. And swiping material.
Interesting.
I went through that too.
Yeah. Where people were taking or lifting your ideas and putting them in their own.
That's exactly right.
Interesting.
Yep. I guess that's when you know you have arrived.
Yeah.
You're subject.
That's supposed to be flattery.
Logic.
Yeah. Stealing is right. A sincere form of flattery. Yeah.
Yeah, right. Not when you're a victim of it. Trust me.
Yes, I can imagine. What was it that was something come to mind that really kind of upset you the most?
I was doing a lecture for a magical group, and I remember Fetch being in the back of the room. I forget, there were two pros who were sitting back there making copious notes.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, when you lecture, you leave the material in somebody else's hands.
Sure.
And it was ridiculous to put restrictions on the knowledge that you were giving to other people in the field. So when one of the effects that was in the lecture appeared in Genie, and fortunately for me, I had given Bill Larson, I think, something like 6 effects to run in consecutive issues of Genie back in the good old days.
Yeah, right, right.
So it appeared not close enough for me to use it as evidence of two guys sitting at a lecture. What the hell are they sitting there for? It's to learn whatever it is that you're giving away.
Yeah.
And so they did what was the end result of my lecturing, in that I gave away stuff. And it's funny how you lay claim to things that have been previously invented.
Yes.
And I think that comes from the tinkering that goes on between the time you first became knowledgeable enough to take effects from the principles and then add to it as you made it more entertaining.
Right. Usually that you continue working on something, and whatever, oftentimes when people are lecturing, they'll say, well, since my notes came out, I have since worked on this, and I've got some additional touches or variations on this. And so you're always working on those things.
That's right. And those things are always there.
Mm-hmm.
So it just gets to the point where you stop and you turn it all off and say, look, this is what I love to do. And I take it as a compliment when people lift material as opposed to being threatening. And I have been involved in so many of those situations. It kind of each one kills the love affair that you're having.
That's too bad.
Yeah.
Because I know that discourages some creators today. There have been some people who have, after contributing so much to our art with different ideas, John Cornelius, for an example, being one who has given a lot of ideas, and people have found ways of manufacturing some of his products much cheaper, and to the point that he said, well, why should I create anything else? And so, again, it discourages creativity in our art.
Yeah, I think you can probably find a lot of that in anybody who has apparently conceived and published magic or metal. And I went through that. I had some very raucous disagreements with the Maven.
Yes.
and some of his disciples. And,
right.
You know, it gets to the point where you just say, hey, I'm not going to be concerned. If I'm actually disseminating the material, then why the hell should I get angry when somebody picks up and uses
exactly.
it?
Exactly. So, you've put it out there. I mean, you cast it to the waters. It's going to come back.
Absolutely. You know, and I said, yeah, I have no right to be upset over these things. But there was so much secrecy in growing up through all those years of magic. I mean, it was almost like a religion.
Mm-hmm.
And the only people that I had in Baltimore, Howie Schwartzman,
right.
who I was very friendly with, but never friends enough for me to trust him in his flying.
I've heard stories about, yeah,
yeah.
getting up in his airplane to be piloting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and he tried like hell all through the years, and then he'd start giving April a fit, you know. Doesn't he trust me?
Yeah.
Not really.
Yeah, not really. Yeah, but, I've heard he gets people up in the plane, and then he kind of pretends like he passes out or lets go of the wheel or whatever.
Yeah, right. and you know, and I just knew him too well to trust him up there.
Yeah.
But I had enough problems with him when we were on the ground.
On the ground, yeah.
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 Between him and Frank Thompson. He would harp on a new move, or at least a new move to him.
Mm-hmm.
And he would remember if he had shown it to you previously. But with me, every time I saw it, I said, oh, that's amazing.
Right.
and I sat behind him at some dinners when he was performing the damn trick.
And get a different angle on it.
Yeah, and he drove me crazy with some of this stuff, which was big back then, well known today.
Sure. You mentioned the PEA a little bit earlier and the founding of that. Why'd you decide to start that forum to begin with, the Psychic Entertainers Association?
Well, as I said, my friendship with Bob began during that period.
Bob Cassidy, yeah.
Uh-huh. And Bob and some of the guys from New York used to make pilgrimages to my house.
Okay.
And in one instance, I had called Bob and gotten his permission to utilize his Russian roulette, which I did for a couple of years. And before I finally sat down and created my own version. Mm-hmm. But Bob used to come down, and I remember taking him down in the basement and showing him the end result of my association with Russian roulette. And when I told him how it was done, he flipped out. He said, "You're absolutely out of your mind."
Yeah.
I said, "Yours wasn't loud enough and it wasn't dangerous enough." So I just kept going.
Yeah.
And that was true. But with Bob's version, the worst thing that can happen to you is that you get a little burn on the back of your neck. That to me, it just didn't sound dangerous, much less look dangerous. And I had the weaponry that was and did what it looked like it should do. These were things that would use for firing a blank, but there was no interruption to the flame, which tended to help make it that much louder.
Yeah.
And to look more dangerous when I stood there, you know, firing the guns in the air during the routine. So he was the first one to see my version, a Russian roulette.
Mm-hmm.
And he never bothered to make the change in what he was doing. And I don't blame him, you know.
Yeah, he kept his own method.
He kept his own method.
Right. So he had decided, or you talked with him about, he was one of the co-sponsors or creators, I guess, of the PEA back then?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. That was in its infancy back then, including some people who never really became active in the PEA.
But the whole idea was just to have a forum, if you will, where they could discuss these ideas among each other in
that's
an online
right.
forum. Yeah.
That's it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the way it started, and who knows the way it has ended up. I find that a lot of the early guys in the PEA are no longer active in it. Mm. You know, you get to the point where everybody who's active in it is many years younger than you are.
Sure. Well, organizations go through evolutions, obviously. And
that's right.
Yeah.
They were there, and we used to have our own private. Then I understood the Howie Schwartzmans of the world.
Yeah.
Howie never sat down and broke bread with a guy who really was in the same category as he was.
Really?
And I think we all became that way. The early birds in mentalism, we kind of, of course, I haven't been there for years, but I was active in the early days.
Right.
And as was Bob and a number of other people. We became particularly friendly with Bob and his unfortunate problems, marital problems.
Right.
And his lifestyle. And he was going south and the rest of the world was going forward or up. But I knew him when.
Yeah, that was too bad. Well, speaking of that, and I want to start to kind of wrap up over here because I know that you've got another appointment here shortly. But I remember some years ago that you were a strong proponent in telling everybody they should go out and get cancer checks. I recall, I think you had prostate cancer.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Can you, you want to get on the soapbox here and tell everybody what they should do and what happened there?
Well, the truth of the matter is that I should have known better. And one day, a next-door neighbor of mine said, have you had a PSA test? And I said, no, the letters don't sound familiar, so obviously right. I don't think I've had it.
Right.
He made me get in a car, and he drove me to the nearest doctor's office and insisted that I be given a PSA test. And unfortunately, what came back was not what I wanted to hear. I was booked at a convention that I believe was held in Baltimore.
Hmm.
And during that convention, Marvin Roy and I went up in a balcony at the theater where the shows were being performed. He was commiserating with me over my newfound problem.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, I know you well enough. He says, I'm not going to give you advice. He says, but I will tell you that if it were me, I would go at prostate cancer with everything in the books. And when I came to in the hospital, mm-hmm. the first phone call I received was from Marvin, and I laughingly told him I did everything that you said I yeah. should do.
Took every treatment possible, yeah.
Yeah, I said, I am now impotent.
Thanks to you, Marvin.
Right.
I need some of your electricity.
Yeah, Mr. Electric. I laid all of it on him, which yeah. was funny as hell. But another really good friend.
But that was something that I recall that you were, a strong proponent. And I think even in your lectures and other times, you were telling everybody that if you get a chance, even if you don't have a chance, make an appointment. Go get a PSA for every man over a certain age to go and have that on a regular basis.
Over 10 years, mm-hmm. April got involved from the standpoint of women.
Yeah.
And I, of course, went out and began to preach the gospel on how to go about defeating the thing.
Mm-hmm.
In order to defeat it, you got to know that it's even there.
Right, right.
So we spent 10 years. We had an organization called the Prostate Cancer Communication Resource,
mm-hmm.
which we utilized. I began adding it to the lecture because it was perfect. I was ending with the tools that I should end with, and that was standing there firing off a pistol in the air,
yeah,
and then equating what they had just witnessed with what many of them were doing by not following through and getting exams.
You're basically playing Russian roulette with yourself.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. By not going and getting that exam. Now, is that organization still active?
No, only in our minds.
Okay.
But it got to be, you feel that when you start these things that other people will pick up on it.
Right.
And if they did, they didn't approach it from the standpoint that we did, but that doesn't mean anything. There is a great awareness of the disease today, much greater than when I had it.
It was back then, that's right. You know, one last thing that I do need to ask you about, only because that people would say you've left out something if I don't ask about your long
right.
association, obviously, with Lee Earle, that... you were involved with him, and that was Mentalism Unlimited?
Well, actually, it goes back to a telephone conversation that I had with Lee. I really hadn't seen or heard from him for many years.
Mm-hmm.
But when I heard what I heard in that reaching out phone call,
yeah.
I jumped in the car, and I drove down to his house. When I went in, I found him curled up in a fetal position in the corner of one of the rooms.
Mm-hmm.
And on the dining room table was covered with unopened bills.
Hmm.
So I knew where he was at,
yeah.
and I was in a position to help. So that's when I told him that if we got together and we put our heads together and our comparable skill sets, we could make a difference. And we did.
And you did.
Mm-hmm. And but at the end, it ended in a very bad situation. He came to my house, and we were discussing a new effect that we were going to bring to market.
Mm-hmm.
And I began to question some of the procedural stuff. And he suddenly took exception to that. And whereas we had a 10-year, very close association,
mm-hmm.
Of working together, he walked out. And when he walked out, I slammed the door behind him, and we've never gone back since.
Okay. So it was basically a difference of opinion on marketing and effect.
That's right. And he felt that he had received the things that I told him he would if he calmed down. And he had gotten there. And for that, I was grateful. I mean, he's very, very bright.
He is, and very creative, as you both are. So it's surprising that, I mean, it's not surprising, I guess, that when you have two creatives like that who want to go
in
a different direction.
You're bound to rub noses, yeah.
Right. It seemed to work well, obviously, for those 10 years you were together with the marvelous products, and I've spent a lot of money on a lot of things that you guys had sold out there, certainly, as did a lot of the rest of the community. I would think and hope with an advanced age that you would eventually make up and say, okay, that was then, and let's move forward, and, you know, sorry we didn't keep together.
Well, he has that option. I didn't slam the door on him.
Mm-hmm.
He slammed the door on himself. And so therefore, I know every move that he made, you know, people would tell me information that I really didn't want to hear.
Yeah.
And I had played a very constructive way in his life, especially with his children, with his son, who was having problems in school, and I had a nephew whose career was wrapped up in solving problems like that, putting the two together. And always told him, I said, you know, you'll end up, you'll have a new computer, you have a new car, you have a new life.
Yeah.
And when he got to the point where he didn't feel that he needed any more help, I guess that's what prompted him to get up and walk out.
Well, you never know what's going on in someone's mind, certainly. I mean, with the recent death of Daryl, that it was unknown of emotional, you know, clinical depression that he was suffering. And there are things like that that, in hindsight, when you see that someone has taken a drastic action like that, and you're thinking, okay, well, I saw the signs, but I couldn't connect the dots. And, you know, let's hope that hope for the best here.
Well, that was one Daryl in particular, because April, through me, knew him very well.
Yes.
And it hit her when I told her that he had passed away.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't give her the details. That wasn't necessary. But these are people that we interface with over the years because we were both dealing in the same subject.
Sure, it's a small community.
Yeah, very small.
Mm-hmm.
And I never wanted to separate from Lee Earl. He did it of his own accord. He's the one who stood up and walked out of my house, and that was it. That was the end of the relationship.
Yeah.
And he had gotten to the point where he felt that he was beyond someone else criticizing something that he was working on. So, you know, he felt he had gotten where he was comfortable, and that was the end of that, and he didn't need me anymore. And that was fine. He ended up with the car that I told him he would have and the new computer and all of the things that go with it. I paid for everything. You know, when you put out a line of work, somebody has to pick up the cost that you incurred in creating that product. And I did that for 10 years. And it was a considerable investment that he didn't have to make, but I did.
Now, is that organization, or I should say that although the partnership may have broken, is there still a line that is being sold or a website where people can go and buy things? And if so, I mean, is that something?
I think people still go to the old website because I'll get calls, you know, from is Mentalism Unlimited still in business? Answer is no.
Okay. So you're not selling anything. You've retired from
that. I really retired, period. And I have taken myself out of performing.
Yeah.
I am proud of what I accomplished.
As you should be.
In magic and mentalism. Mm-hmm. And I was satisfied, and I think smart enough to realize that I had reached the end of the road.
You know when to hang up your nail writer.
Yeah, that's exactly what happened. Mm-hmm. And I did. And, you know, I sit here surrounded by the books and all the reminders.
Oh, goodness. I mean, so many awards and things. I remember at the Mindvention, you were the guest of honor there one year as well in Vegas, as well as, you said, the SAM Hall of Fame, and I'm certain several other awards. As I start to, again, wrap up over here, that the name of my podcast is called The Magic Word Podcast. And so my question, Larry, is to you, what is important in your life at this point in your life? What is your, it's not necessarily a word, it could be a phrase, it could be a sentence, a mantra, something that has kept you going, you know, when you get up in the morning, as you say, you're lifting your head up and putting one foot in front of the other. You know, what it may relate to magic or mentalism. What is your magic word or phrase?
Well, I'll never stop performing and even entertaining kids mm-hmm. in a restaurant. I always keep a little trick in my pocket.
Yeah.
So I'm never at a loss to create amazement and a deck of cards.
Yeah. So never be at a loss for creating amazement. Yeah.
That's absolutely.
Yeah. So even though, as you were saying, that you're no longer performing, it's just you're not performing professionally, but you always have something with you that you can create a moment.
That's right.
Yeah. And that's what's important. Wow. You've had quite a life of things that you have done and people you've met and achieved, and I am honored to have spent a little bit of time with you here, and I know that the listeners will appreciate hearing from you and the stories you were sharing, too.
Well, I appreciate the fact that you remembered me.
Oh. No, it's never too late, never too late, certainly. And I was hoping that I was going to get a chance to do this face-to-face. My mother lives in Phoenix, and I thought, well, I'm going to be getting out there soon in a few months and stop by to a visit. And I still intend to do that when I get out there.
But absolutely.
I just thought I would give you a call here.
The room with the books and the remnants of my performing career are all surrounding me as we speak.
Are all there. Well, great. So there we go. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And so for the Magic Word Podcast, that was Larry Becker, and this is Scotty out. Well, I'm thrilled to have an opportunity to present this podcast to you guys, and I hope that you enjoyed it as much as I enjoyed having the opportunity to first speak with Larry for this conversation over Skype and then to have the opportunity to visit his home. If you go to the website at themagicwordpodcast.com, there you can see some of the photos that I'd taken there in his library and at his house with him and his wife, April. And so, again, I want to thank both of them for opening their home and also for Larry for opening up his mind and kind of sharing some of these recollections of his life. It's been wonderful. But before we go this week, I want to go back to the drawing board. Well, actually, I want to go back to the drawing. We had postponed the drawing from this past week and had pushed it forward until this week. And what drawing, you might say, for those of you who might be listening to this for the first time and missed the last couple of podcasts? Well, a couple of weeks ago, we spoke with David Girard, and he had offered us a copy of his hardback book called Out of My Hat, which is a set basically of more than just lecture notes. I mean, it talks about a lot of things, a really good book, a lot of really good advice. His lecture was outstanding, and I used some of the things from his book. And so anyhow, he had offered us a copy of the book. He was going to be having a limited edition of these printed up, and he offered one then to a lucky listener who can enter in for a chance to win. And so we had dozens and dozens of people who had registered, and I want to thank everybody for entering the contest. But again, there's only one winner, and we did a random selection using the randomizer on the spreadsheet that we have. And the lucky winner is Matt Furtado. Congratulations, Matt. And for the rest of you whose names were not drawn, be sure to watch and listen for future podcasts when you never know that there might be another contest offered then. Well, I want to wish each of you a happy Halloween.
I am telling you this now because the next time we visit, it'll be on the other side of October, and we'll be into November and beginning the busy holiday season. I hope that each of us gets a lot of bookings and we have just a great time, and be sure and show everybody the best magic you can possibly show them, because it's important that they see good magic. So the next time they want to book entertainment, they think magic and magician, because they have seen a good magician, because they've seen you, and you become a better magician because you've been listening to these podcasts and you know how to entertain. Well, I think that's a good place to wrap it up. So until next week, stay well, get booked, and never be at a loss for creating amazement. This is Scotty out.